Welcome to Filmmaking Framed, your video podcast interviewing industry professionals to find out the realities of filmmaking. With us today is director Toby McDonald, who's recently been BAFTA nominated for Extraordinary on Disney Plus for scripted comedy. His debut short film, Je T'aime John Wayne, was BAFTA nominated, and his debut feature, Old Boys, premiered at Edinburgh Film Festival. Great to have you with us, Toby.
Great to be here.
So directing is a role that everyone on the film set kind of interacts with, and everyone has a view on what it's like to be a director. But I suppose it's one of those roles that actually, without visibility on it, there can be a lot of kind of misunderstandings. How would you define the role of a director?
I would say that the role of the director is to bring to life the script and to have a really profound understanding of the way that an audience watches and interacts with a piece of film.
And how do you gain that kind of insight into how an audience will react?
For me personally, it comes from a lot of sitting in a cinema watching films with audiences. I think that's the kind, for myself, that's the sort of core experience. I remember that as a boy, just being a sort of total magic, and I've sort of carried that on. So I go to the cinema all the time, often on my own. I talk about it like I'm going to work when I go to the cinema. And I suppose that's the sort of foundational experience that I return to again and again. And I think that applies to television as well. So it's that thinking about how the audience are going to experience something, and what for me as a filmmaker, it's about the kind of the deep pleasures of being in being in the audience or watching a film. And so, for example, on Extraordinary, comes down to the real joy of the characters. I think so. Character is a thing that I'm always looking for, and I think is a bit of an underestimated thing in a lot of modern filmmaking, definitely.
And I'm really interested, because when you go and see these films, do you try and see them when they're just released, where they're likely to have the largest audience? Or
That's a really good question. I try to see things with the biggest crowd possible if I can. Sometimes that's not always possible, but I'm always trying to go to the movies all the time. And it's interesting when you talk to people in the industry, it's almost like the thing that they never have time to do. And I think that it's really important to keep in touch with that. And also to try, I think, to keep an open mind with it. There's an incredible amount of media now about what you ought to think about a film. And I think that's the joy of film festivals as well, because you get to just go to things that you haven't had sort of 50 film articles bombarded. You haven't been bombarded with those. So I think that, yeah, I just try to keep going, keep watching as much as possible to stay in touch with that audience feeling, I think.
That makes a ton of sense.
I went to a BAFTA event a number of years ago, and I remember talking to a director there, and it's the irony of the industry being, you know, such long hours when you're working. The irony is that you don't get much time to actually watch films and watch TV shows. I wonder whether you could sort of highlight to our audience a bit about what a working week for a director might look like. So you're booked on a job, you know, what's your process both before being on set and on when you are on set?
Yeah, so there are sort of probably three main stages: prep, shoot, and post. All of them very distinct. Prep week would involve casting, locations, shot listing, meetings with various departments, meetings with executives to talk about tone, to talk about where things were going. You'd be meeting with the writer. And I think what you're doing really is tailoring the suit that you're then going to wear for the shoot in a very careful, deliberate way. I absolutely love prep. I think it's amazing. It's a great time to get into lots of creative relationships with various departments. That's something that I try really hard to do. I want everybody to feel like they're filmmaking alongside the director's department. I don't I don't want those things all to be separate. It's about creating relationships with the actors. You know, you have to, I always try to make time for rehearsal within the prep period. So that the prep weeks are insanely busy. Ideally, you've kind of pre-prep, you've run the marathon before everybody else. So then you're helping explaining everybody how to them, how you're going to run that marathon together. And then the shoot is something that you're ticking off all the things that you've prepped so carefully for through the shoot. And obviously then you, as everybody says, you prepare insanely well, and then you're open through the shoot. And then post is, again, for example, on a TV series, is a very structured, scheduled process towards delivering on time. And I think that the thing that I would say from my point of view as a director is that throughout that process with all your collaborators, you're trying to win upwards. So you're presenting work locations to executives, you're explaining through all of that. Then you have, for example, like a cast read through, and you're hopefully setting a tone with that makes all the executives understand what you're doing, makes the studio understand what you're doing. And then you're through the shoot as well, you're assembling, as well as kind of creating the performances and all those things, you're assembling rushes as you go along. And that as well is something that you need to be, you're explaining through those to the executives how the show is going to work. So then when you get to the edit, you are, again, you're in a great position and everybody's facing the same direction. So that's a big part of that for me, not in a controlling way, but winning makes it seem like you're competing against someone else. But what you're trying to do is bring everybody with you in a really unified way. I think that then means that once you get into the detailing of your vision for it, everybody's supportive of that. Does that make sense?
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah.
I suppose that's, obviously you've worked across television and film.
Yeah.
I suppose in a television sense, it might make sense that you've got the TV channel, the commissioner, whatever it is, as well as the company making it. And in film, you'd have financiers and various people. So you're always, as a director, you're always accountable to those executives.
I'm always trying to collaborate, you know, with everybody. I think that there is I know that probably maybe we'll talk about that in the greatest myths about your job later, but I feel like that makes projects stronger. You know, I'm really lucky that I get to work with incredibly talented people, and I'm constantly trying to activate them and their imaginations and their skills and thought about a project, and trying to keep that all in the direction that I feel it should go. I mean, obviously that's a discussion very early on, but you're trying to keep a kind of unity to that all the way, and the more that you can bring people on board with that, I think that's a really important part of it, and is a part of it that is inevitable in modern, you know, in modern television. I would say definitely filmmaking, the director can take a different kind of control, and what he says often is sort of law in terms of that. But again, I would say that there's still the joys of our job is collaboration. I would say, I think that I shot a lot of commercials, and so part of that job is about how you communicate with other people about what your intentions are. And so that's something that I learned a lot from. When you're filming, you have sort of 15 people standing behind you, looking at everything that you're doing, asking you questions. And I think that gives you a skill at being able to bring everybody with you on something. Because if you start getting into fighting battles on these things, you know, about your vision or about those things, that can just take up so much time and resources that could be spent better.
It sucks a lot of the energy out of the process.
Yeah, very much so. And I think that's something that young directors are like, you know, here we go, we're gonna smash into this, and and this is what I think, and this is, and there's like a desire to have like a sort of total decisiveness, a sort of Christopher Nolan sort of omnipotent ability with those things, which is totally wonderful if you can get to that. But I think that for me personally, I learned so much from different people as I went along. And I found the joy for me is collaborating with other departments and everybody being a filmmaker together, I think. And I would extend that to the location department, to the, you know, to hair and makeup, to all of those things. It's going to be better. It's all going to be better and stronger if you're working collaboratively with people.
So, where do you think that those young directors are getting that approach from? Are they overconfident or misunderstanding? Or
I think that there's obviously the sort of myth of the sort of super filmmaker that can do everything. I think that those people do definitely exist. But I think that, and I think a lot of that comes from sort of press and, you know, making ofs that are sort of massaged and those kinds of things. But I think it's a desire to have all the answers. And I think that the thing that the joy that I found with prep is that it can be a journey that you can go on and incorporate other people's views in a really brilliant and a beautiful way and still be decisive about those things. It's not about being indecisive. And I think it's an idea of directing that is a little bit old fashioned, I would say. It's like the sort of Jodhpurs and the loud hailer and those kinds of things. It's not to say that you don't need to be that like that in certain moments, but I think that conflict, you need to find ways to resolve conflict and to bring people with you all the time, I would say, because it's also an economic thing. You know, time is your absolute resource, and you need to be explaining to people properly what you need from them and what their role is, I think, as well. So it's a bit of a sort of myth of the Superman thing, and also a desire from people to feel like they need to have all the answers straight away. And that's not really true in any other kind of creative art. Think about a painter, or, you know, they're bumping around quite a lot before they get to where they need to be, I think.
So it sounds like, as in many roles on the film set, but that directors particularly have to have those people skills so that you actually know when you can push a vision really strongly and when you need to bring someone with you.
Yeah, definitely. I think that and learning about when those moments are as well, learning when to go hard and when to be soft about it. You know, I think working alongside actors is a really good example of that. You know, every single actor, from someone with one line to your lead, is completely different, and you need to find ways to activate each of them in a really kind of positive, imaginative way. You need to discover what kind of artist they are, and you need to be different with all of them. I suppose there's the sort of the way that some directors work is that they just don't do that. They don't get involved in that. But I'm sure we'll talk about how the industry's changing. You know, you need to find ways to interact with people from very many different backgrounds and different types of creativity. And I think that that's a really critical part of being a director, I think.
I was wondering if we could really dive a bit more into that prep stage.
Yeah.
You say it's quite critical. I guess my question is how soon are you brought on? How long do you get to actually come up with your own plan? And then what is the process of bringing on collaborators? So the DOP, the production designer, do you get a say on who those people are? I presume you'd like working with the same people again for the reason that you know how they work.
Yeah.
The collaborative process. Could you kind of talk through those?
Yeah. So I'll get sent. So we'll talk about television and series. I'll get sent a script. That then I'll go and have an initial meeting on that script. That will usually be with executives and a producer. Often, if the execs and the producer are a sort of ahead of the game, they'll have found a production designer already, and they'll find maybe they'll even have found some locations already as well. So they're already kind of, they've already got a clear idea about what type of show this might be. I will then make like a really kind of detailed pitch to them in that first meeting. I'll take a huge amount of reference. I'll talk about, you know, various different things. I'll usually try to pinpoint specific tonal inflection points or knots that I feel like, well, this is a key tonal thing. So how I deal with this is going to show you how I feel about the whole project. So there might be like a specific scene or a shift from comedy to making the audience cry. I'll talk about how I'll deal with that. Then the next meeting often is then with the writer, and that's to, sometimes those are in a different order, but sometimes you'll meet with a writer, and that's to sort of talk with the writer and get their intention as well. And then if after that, if you're lucky enough to get through those stages, then you'll go to meet with the studio and you'll talk to them about it. But you're being probably put forward as a preferred candidate at that moment.
When you say get through those stages, you're still through an interview process?
You're still being interviewed, and you're still, you know, and this is where your communication starts, you know, and this is where you're talking about tone, talking about how something can look, talking about what you want the audience to feel, and how aligned you are with what they're thinking. And also, like, it's not just thinking what they want. It's also very much thinking how you would do it and what your kind of strengths are. I think you need to show a really profound understanding of what the project is, and what the intentions of the writing are, and then how you would visually bring that to life. And then after you've done the studio, then hopefully you're hired. From that, you've talked with them, you understand what they want, and then there would be a start date for prep. You'd be given 10 weeks prep and however long the shoot is from there. I think that that stage is absolutely critical. You need to have a full idea of how you're going to shoot it in the first meeting. I would say, I don't think you can go into first meetings without like a comprehensive idea of that. And then I think, as to your point about bringing on crew, it's helpful to work with people that you've worked with before. I think you need to tailor it to the job, but I think it's really important to be open to new people, because I think that's part of the joy of modern television, especially, is that you're working with lots of different really talented people. I think there's a reference system, so people will ask for references on me. They'll go out and get lots of references on the director, and then every single crew member as well. And I've been in production offices at the beginning of that process when they're starting the hiring of crew, and the reference process is a really critical part of that. And you can hear them on the phone, which sometimes I wish I had not heard, them talking to other people that you've worked with, or not necessarily you, or other people that your suggested crew member has worked with, and they're getting real details. And part of that, that's a really big underneath part of the business, is everybody knows how hard it is. So in the production manager, all of those things. And so they'll really ring around trusted people to find out, you know, people that you've worked with. And that is a sort of underlying thing about how people get jobs. That's true for runners, you know, first ADs. It's a massive thing, and that's why you have to, you know, it's important to keep your relationships really good. And I don't mean that in a cynical way, but it's about being professional, you know, and that starts when you're a runner, I think, as well. So I would say that to everybody, you can't afford to sort of blow things up in places. You have to find ways to, and that's only going to help you when you get to more management positions, because you've got an understanding of how people talk about people and how the industry works.
That's interesting, is that you just made me think of, I was thinking, oh, you know, unless you could fully finance your own projects, and then you can kind of be a diva. But then even then, I suppose, people won't want to come onto your project because they still have to do it for their work. It's their every day, you know. So even if you were totally self-funding your own projects, in order to find collaborators, you also have to have that reputation of being good to work with.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that that's not like a, like you say, I don't think that's a cynical thing. I think that that's an important part of getting really good work out of people, is that they enjoy coming to work. It's a hard job, you know, in any department. I'm talking about every department. It's really, really hard. That's a given. So then, you know, the other stuff around that is really critical. You know, you talk to people about having good caterers or something like that. Do you know what I mean? It's like all of those details are really, really critical. Providing like a good lunch on a recce, you know, those kinds of things are part of the experience. I know it seems crazy for a director to think about those things, but everything affects then how you're working, how people are engaged, yeah. all of those things.
Like how crews work together is almost like a living organism.
Very, very much so. And if you're lucky enough to have really good line producers and producers and first ADs, then that all is part of it. But the at the center of that is the director and what the director asks of crew. And I think that there, you know, you can either engage in a process with that, or you can be very results oriented. So you could just say, I want this, you know, this needs to be that, or you can try and help people to get to where you want to be and help them to understand what you want as well. But I think making a good experience for people is a part of it. And I suppose for me personally, making films and TV films feels like a privilege and a joy. And I love the other side of it, like watching it. So I want people to feel that positivity in, you know, I think that sometimes an audience, you know, maybe if you're making like a really sort of intricate drama, but for me, I'm making character pieces and I want that joy on set to come through to the audience. That maybe might be a bit naive, but that's part of
it's a good approach to have.
Yeah, that's how I like to approach it. It doesn't mitigate the hardness of the job though. It's still going to be hard.
Could you talk a little bit about what the relationship is like with the first AD? The kind of perspective from the kind of set side is that it's kind of director and writer with the vision, and then the first AD is the one that makes the trains run on time.
Yeah.
Can I just intercede, sir, because we're aiming this podcast at people who might not know. So
yeah, for sure.
AD is a first assistant director, so they're working closely with you. So
yeah, good shout.
Yeah, I don't think when I was younger, I don't think I understood how to kind of fire up that relationship in the best way that I could. I think I maybe just approached it as a train running on time thing. But I think the thing that what you tend to find as you get older is that, not that I'm that old, but the people being on set, actors, sound people, ADs, runners, people in the camera department, the days and years of being on set gives them like a craft about how things are made. So they have a really profound understanding of the economy of how a day on a set might work, how a shot can be made, where an extra needs to stand, all of those things. So first ADs are, you can treat them, you know, people do use them just as a way to get from A to B. But I think that the really best ones, and I've worked with some through commercials, I've worked with kind of Terry Rawlings, Chris Newman, one of the all-time great first ADs. And they have an ability as a filmmaker to make shots, help you with those things. And if you can activate them in creatively as well, and find ways to explain your vision to them as well, not keep it private, but open it up to that department, engage a second AD, talk about the style of extras that you want, the way you want movement on the set to work, the feelings that you want, then that is like an amazing kind of creative tool. As well, they're responsible for kind of, you need to have someone that you're with that they can give you a look where you're like, okay, we need to move on. you know, as well. That's part of it too. And you need to trust to that with them, I think. And they need to trust you that you're not going to blow the day, because what happens is at the end of the day, if you don't make a day, then they'll be the first people that the producer goes to and says, what the F is going on here? Why aren't we making this day? You know, and that's a part of it. If the producers and the line producers are really good and experienced, then they'll see that sometimes you might not make a day, not because you were being irresponsible, but because you were trying to get extra coverage or you're trying to do something extra. And sometimes that stuff happens. But the first AD is also very beholden to production in that way as well. So there's a tension that you have to live in with that. That they're with you, they're with you as a director, you're trying to, but they're also explaining to production how things work. And I think as shoots have kind of got bigger and you know, we've been through a boom and people have been promoted up in different ways, experiences, people's experience has changed. So it's really key that you can explain what your intentions were to first can explain it to a line producer who maybe isn't as experienced as the line producer on your previous job, and that you can live a little bit in the tension that is always going to be there between the creative and the production. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes absolutely.
Yeah.
How much of a debrief do you have after a shoot day? So you've got that prep stage, then you're shooting, and then per day, how much time do you get after a shoot before you go into the next day to have those conversations?
I think it depends on where you're at with the schedule. Whether you've, you know, I think it's a constant assessment. You're constantly assessing it. You're constantly trying to work out what the inefficiencies are, what's efficient. Are you, you know, did you shoot too many takes of the wide shot before you went in? Should you start with the close-ups? You know, it's like a constant evolving thing. And I think you have to be nimble and smart. It's helpful to have experience because you can kind of see where things might be slipping or going wrong. It could be a particular department isn't your communication with a particular department wasn't as good as it could have been, and so something was slow. But I think you're always trying to communicate and talk through those. Sometimes you get to the end of a day and the day's been so complex, hard, you're just like, you can't talk anymore. Let's begin again in the morning. You know, there would have been tensions on the set, those kinds of things. I think it's important to try and go straight to the, if you've had like a, if there's been like a blow up or a thing like that, I think you've got to go straight to that thing after you finish shooting and try and address it so it doesn't malinger overnight. But I feel like your shoots, you're constantly assessing, and as well, it doesn't matter how much incredible prep you've done, you're still prepping through the shoot as well, constantly for the next thing. You might be a location might not have worked through no one's fault, you know, and you've got to try and find, you've got to go and look at that location. You've got to find your energy again to go and do that and approach all of that stuff really positively as well in a problem solving way.
Or like on season 2 of Extraordinary, we had a cast member get COVID right at the start of shoot, and then we had to redo the shooting schedule.
Yeah, we'd had the most beautifully wrought schedule that was intricately made and all that stuff, and then on the first week and everything detonates, and you've got to try and, I think there's a balance as well. The temptation is to just say, right, just carry on, we're going to charge into it, but you've got to try and reassess everything from that point as well. And you've got to make your day, you know, like that's the, as a director, that's, I suppose, the pressure that the director holds throughout that maybe like the sound department don't necessarily hold. Although I would say when you have a crew functioning really beautifully, then it's a shared achievement that you make the day. Yeah, exactly. In that way as well.
I was wondering, obviously, in the producer production side of things, obviously a lot of things, as you say, can change around. When you're, as a director, working on set and they have things that like something needs to change, but it needs to be communicated to you, but you're in the middle of getting scenes and delivering the day. What's that process like so that you can pivot? Obviously, you might have a conversation over lunch, but if they've, you know, what's the process when you're capturing the day live, but also you're thinking ahead, and, you know, what's that?
I think it's just a sort of ongoing thing. I think the first AD is really critical in that they hold quite a lot of that conversation, and then they might choose the moment to come and talk about that. I think there are times when, as a director, you want to be able to concentrate on the you're trying with the actors to get like the perfect thing, like the exact right way of doing something. So that there's that moment, but at the same time, sort of contemporary directing is always about you've always got an undercurrent of problem solving going on all the time, you know, of problem solving, of dealing with, you know, things that aren't quite working, or, you know, a crew member can't come in on a certain day, and so you've got to find a different way to solve it. And your cinematographer is part of that as well. And that role, I think, there's an enormous pressure on cinematographers. Now they're elevated a lot because of their role in making the day as well, and making the schedule, and how the schedule might work, and all of those things too. So I think it's about sharing that with the, I would say the solution to that is sharing that with the team and having a good relationship with a producer, that they know when to come and talk to you about it. And also being able to say, do you know what, I'm just going to do this now, and then I'll come and chat with you. And that not being like a kind of diss moment, you say that politely, and in just a simple way. And you're always trying to communicate, you know, tone of voice is a really critical thing, I think, as a, when you're managing people. And I think the other interesting thing, it's a slight digression, but I remember Anthony Mignello was a really brilliant director, and I was reading an interview with him, and he said it's a mistake that a lot of directors make, that they think that other people are not as sensitive as they are. So you can treat somebody, you know, you think that you're the one being assailed by everything. The director can sometimes think that, and that oh, this person doesn't, you know, they're not feeling it. You know, you can talk to them in whichever way, you know. And I think that he was so right about that. It's like, you need to treat people in a way that they're as sensitive as you are to those things. So you know, raising your voice or those pressure moments, people are very grateful where you're, if you're able to handle a moment of pressure in a calm way, I think as well. I mean, we're talking about getting into the industry and those kinds of things. But I suppose this is, again, another way in which the industry is changing, because it used to be that lots of directors would just shout their way through things. And some people still try and do that. But I don't think that's the best way to get a modern crew working really well and happily, I think, too. So I think you have to approach people sensitively.
What do you think has kind of driven that change to make it so the director needs to be more collaborative, and those kind of ruled by fiat days are more gone than they were ever?
I think it's a societal change. I think it's a change in the approach to how sets need to be run. I think that the recent boom has meant that crew had more choice in things, and that sort of shifted things. But I think it's as well like an understanding of people, and an understanding of not carrying sort of a terrible dysfunction, that filmmaking doesn't need to be dysfunctional in that way. And I think it's about what your values are as well. You know, it's really interesting working on Extraordinary. You have four young lead actors in that who I've tried to instill in them, and they have it naturally. So I'm not taking the credit, but it's like they have a leadership role. You know, their fortitude and creativity and all those things is a real big part of that show. And I think that they have standards of how they want things to be done on set. So they wouldn't accept that kind of atmosphere. And I think that that's really an important part of it, I think, as well. And I would say that's true of the company that make it. So Gentle have an expectation of how that needs to be. And I think that there's a kind of balancing of young crew and the old ways and all those kinds of things. And I think I'm hoping that it's getting better, you know. It's a whole other thing for us to talk about mental health and care and time off and all those things in filmmaking. But I think that it's really important that it happens, you know, in our industry, I think.
And it definitely feels like progress has been made on that.
Yeah, I think so. Equality, you know, different people in different roles, different people in leadership roles, all of those kinds of things. It's just so important. I don't know why filmmaking was sort of exempt from the workplace, you know, in that way before. And it's still quite kind of baffling. Some of the kind of vicissitudes of it and the way the balance of schedules and production and those kinds of things. But I think it's definitely getting better, and it's really important. And to people who are listening to this, who are thinking of stepping into the industry again, I would say it's really, really hard. There's no hiding from that, but I think it's definitely getting better.
I wonder if we could perhaps go into there for those listeners. What are the steps to becoming a paid working director? And maybe we could start with a little bit about your journey, and then any advice you might have for those people.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I'm different in that I didn't go to film school. I started off as a runner. So I started off as an unpaid runner. It was a time when if you wanted to get into the business, your being unpaid was a way to sort of get that the first job. I started off running on commercials. Then I started getting paid. I worked as a runner on films. And I suppose the thing for me, and I this might resonate with some people, was that I never really admitted that I wanted to be a director. I was broadly just obsessed and fascinated with filmmaking, going to films, everything to do with it, acting, all of it. It was just a total, and still is, you know, complete passion and obsession. So I'd be reading books, and, you know, books about film are a huge thing for me beyond working in it. I try and read almost everything that I can about it. And that's a really thrilling thing. But that's sorry, go ahead.
Do you have any recommendations of books?
I will send you a whole list for that, definitely. There are too many to name that are just amazing. I would say Sidney Lumet's book about directing is one of the great ones, and Alexander McKendrick's book about filmmaking. Those are two of the really great practical ones. So, yeah, I was running on films. Then I became a director's assistant. So I worked for a really brilliant director who was called Brian Gibson. He directed Blue Remembered Hills by Dennis Potter. And he'd just come back from America, where he had done What's Love Got to Do with It, the Tina Turner story. So I worked for him reading scripts.
Can I ask, sorry, how do you make that sidestep? Was it just a case of applying and being at the right time?
Yeah, I think that I knew somebody. So it was about, I always found that once you stepped into it, that once you had were running, then you would start to hear about other jobs. I'd also went to New York for a bit to work in documentary. So I was quite open about which parts of the business. So I went to New York to work in documentaries. I worked for PBS over there, running and doing every type of job possible. I also did an internship at an agency in Los Angeles for for several months working as a sort of unpaid assistant there as well. That was in my, I'd gone to university as well. So I was working in the holidays, doing things from the sort of age of 16, running and stuff. And so the running thing, I was doing that. And then I heard about the director's assistant job and I went and met on that and managed to get that. And that then led to another director's assistant job, working for another really brilliant director called Ian Softley, who did Wings of the Dove and Hackers and K-Pax. He's an amazing, super talented director. And I worked in his office. He was getting lots of scripts. And so I would read for him and do that stuff. And I found my running skills were really helpful doing that. And so then he was working on a film and with a producer, and the producer's assistant was I'd known a little bit before, and we were like, we should make a short film. So Ian,
this is Luke.
This is my friend Luke, yeah. Morris, who was a brilliant, had like a really brilliant understanding of how short films worked and how they could be seen. All of those things. So we made Ian went off to Los Angeles to shoot a film. I was left in London. And so in the summer when he was away, I made a short film with Luke. We did it with lots of other people who were assistants at the same time. So it was a director's assistant, a producer's assistant. We raised enough money just to film it. We spent 6 months prepping it, which is the thing that I would say, that kind of measure 50 million times and then cut once. Like, we were very, very specific about the prep phase of it. And it took us a very long time because we knew that we had sort of a single chance for it to make an impact. I think the thing that I meet quite a lot of people who want to make shorts, and lots of people want to direct shorts. But the thing that was incredibly lucky for me was to have a producer. And that's the thing that people who want to direct shorts seem to struggle with. They don't have a collaborator to make it with. So that's the thing that was the real difference there. He was and still is just really brilliant at that. And so we kind of gradually got it off the ground and shot it in 4 days using, I think the key thing with that was that we had the most brilliant cinematographer. So I think that's the other thing with shorts, is that if you're trying, you've got to think where this is going to be next level. How's this thing going to be next level? At the time, lots of short films were quite influenced by sort of Lynn Ramsey. They were about sort of kids and their point of view, and they were quite gritty. And I think for me and Luke, we wanted to make something cinematic and big screen, something that felt like it belonged on the big screen, because we were watching loads of shorts and we thought, well, we want to try and make an impact with this. How are we going to do that? And so we made the short. It took us another 6 months to raise the money to do all the post. We had a brilliant editor called Saskia Simpson, who was working for an editor called Tarek Anwar at that time, who was also brilliant. And we finally got it finished. We sent it out to festivals on VHS, finally got the print finished the day of the London Film Festival. I remember carrying it was still warm from it being unprinted. This was in the time of a film, and we played it at the London Film Festival and it won the short film section. And so from then on, from that point on, yeah, I was sort of a director from that moment on. But does that all make sense?
Yeah, it sort of talks about, I think, the importance of having a for you, a generation, but a group of collaborators that you work with.
Yeah.
Sort of spoke about that on Extraordinary, of having a collaborative process.
Yeah.
Even when you're getting your shorts off the ground, you know, having, whether you went to film school and it's your fellow students, or whether it's people you make films with, who are friends from school, or people that you say that you've met on set, or
yeah,
you know, that you're collaborating with. And I suppose that goes back to the start of the interview about the importance of having a good reputation and being good with people. So for you getting that first step as a director's assistant. You were already building your reputation as a hard worker and a decent person to work with as a runner. So you didn't get ahead of yourself by being like, oh, I am a director and I'm important.
No.
You'd already built that reputation there as a runner. And then you were able to translate that into an opportunity with a director's assistant role.
Yeah.
Because you already had been working hard and building that reputation.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. I think that I loved being a runner. I absolutely loved it. I felt like it was a job where you could really shine. And it also taught me so much about, exactly as you say, like the hard work required, what people need in the kind of hierarchy process, how to go the extra mile, all of those things. But also that you were presentable, that you understood people in that way. And I think that the other thing that I was doing was always thinking, like, how would I do this? It was like a kind of, I don't know, it's a slightly superstitious thing. Like, I wouldn't say to people, oh, I'm going to be a director, you know, all of this kind of stuff. So I would never talk about it at all. I didn't talk about it probably until the day that we started prepping for Shatame John Wayne. But I think that I was always thinking, how would I do this? How would I stage that? The joke, where's the joke? You know, all of those things. Even when I was working for those directors, I was thinking, well, you could have done that a bit differently, but I was keeping it very private, but always thinking as though, you know, thinking with that and thinking about the responsibility, you know, as well, and understanding the responsibility that those different roles have, even a director of documentaries or those kinds of things. And I think that is a, you it kind of insulates you a little bit because you're keeping it private, but you're also, when it comes to saying it or doing it, you've got to do it like really fully as well. That was the amazing thing,
using it as a learning experience.
Very much so. I think that's really critical. You've got to approach everything in that way and think about what sort of nutrition you're getting from doing even the sort of shittiest, or, you know, you're taking someone's dry cleaning in or something, like where you're questioning your very role, you know, or booking haircuts. You know, I used to talk to other assistants. I never had to do that, but like those kinds of things, you're just like, wait, what? I'm learning. There's something to be learned from all of that. And I suppose I would never ask anyone to book my own haircut for me. What you learn. Yeah, totally. Totally.
And I'm really curious, because I read an article you did where you had an interview where you talked about making The Old Boys.
Oh, yeah.
And you, in the article, you said making shorts today is easier than it was, but it's now harder to get it distributed because there's obviously more being made. Because when you did Jatem, you did it in film, and whereas now virtually all shorts that are shot would be shot in digital.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing. It's like it's become easier, but it's because of that, because of the means of production have simplified, but because of that, there are way more shorts. And I suppose that the shorts kind of market or circuit then was much, you could sort of plot things in a much easier way. I mean, obviously the key thing is that your short is good. You know, that's like the basic thing. But I think that there was something about the complications of making it, the value of the film. And I wasn't particularly good on that. We set off and did some car stuff, views of London, and I virtually used way too much film. It was the first thing. It was not the best start in terms of economy of that. But I think that meant that you had to do an enormous amount of pre-thought, so that, and that's a really good lesson. So you're thinking about what the impact is. Luke was so brilliant. He would think about, like, if you're thinking about program of shorts, like, you know, a short about something serious, another short about something serious. Here's a comedy short that is about film, that looks amazing, that pulls you into a world, that all of that stuff. In a program, like, you know that you're going to, not only is it going to stand out, but it's going to be, the audience are like desperate for something. Yeah, exactly. They know that they can enjoy it. They can laugh. You know, I mean, that's whole other thing to talk about with comedy and film and relatability and all of those things, but they can enjoy it. And that's like, we were calculated about that. It didn't affect the artistry and the, in what we're doing, but we wanted it to be that, you know, we wanted it to be cinematic, and we were very strict about it being under 10 minutes. I see a lot of shorts now that are long. Don't do it. Just don't do it. Like, make it short and make it like, you know, really that's the form. I just say that to everybody, make it under 10. And, you know, especially with people's attention spans now, if you can't say it under 10, you know, we, a short that we did that was like 7 minutes, and that got, or 7 or 8 minutes, you know, that got BAFTA nominated and all of those things. I think that that time is really critical as well.
From a festival's perspective as well, when they're curating a bunch of films, if they can show, you know, 3 10-minute films or 1 30-minute film, they would much rather show 3 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
You also have a bigger chance of getting selected for festivals the shorter it is. It also allows you to hone your craft on being actually efficient with your storytelling.
Yeah.
But I think it's really interesting what you say, that, you know, the technology used to kind of force you to plan so you didn't waste film and you didn't, you know, whereas now, I guess with the digital technology, you can just kind of go out and shoot, but that you shouldn't, that you really should still try and plan and.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's a contradictory thing. You know, there's like, okay, you go and shoot it. You know, I don't know if you saw like the Fablemans, and he's making like war films with blood splatter and all of that kind of stuff. There's like a balance between the energy of just going out and doing some of those things, or kind of really considering and waiting and doing it. But I suppose what the technology does now is allow you to make roughs, you know, to pre-visualize things, to pre-shoot stuff, and then do it really fully.
I suppose then maybe what we're coming up against is making short films for the art of learning to make short films.
Yeah.
And making short films that you intend to push your, you know, your personal brand and get recognition and get seen by people.
Yeah.
You know, I started making films when I was 12. They were just like little stop motion animations. And then I was doing what many people do, which is a zombie movie.
Oh, fun.
And then when I was in my late teens, it was the very stereotypical, very dark, you know, death, murder.
Sure.
A lot of, you know, teenagers make. And, but those films are films I probably wouldn't share if I were trying to earn a career, you know, as a, for me, a producer, you director. But they were valuable at the time. So I suppose, yeah, you're right that you should spend the time if you're intending that film to be good versus go with people and feel free to just shoot and learn. But I suppose you still need to plan those shoots.
Yeah, totally. I think what you say about festivals is really interesting as well. It's like really thinking about what the audience experience is going to be, you know, talking to programmers, going to short film festivals, really thinking about that. I don't think that's a kind of calculated thing. I think it's really important to understand the form that you're working in. Even now, if I'm working on a TV show, you've got to think like who that's for, what's that, you know, all of those kinds of things. I think it's like again, I suppose what it comes down to is how much audience empathy you have. You know, really brilliant filmmakers make it feel like they've made it for themselves, but their understanding of how an audience experiences something is really profound. And I think that applies to shorts as well. In a really, you need to think it through really, really carefully and be really calculated with it.
Changing gears slightly, I'm really, with that kind of audience empathy, I'm really curious how the rise of kind of binge, like TVs that release all the episodes at once or multiple episodes, how that changes the kind of episodic nature of filming. Because before it was like you had to have the week to week, and I remember with Lost it was like, oh, what's in the hatch? And whereas now, if you think your audience are going to be at different points, it's harder to get that kind of community of everyone being at the same knowledge.
Yeah.
And then also from the, you know, episode one doesn't necessarily need to be as, you have to now watch the season, because you can get maybe 2-3 episodes out of people before they will decide if they want to finish a show.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. That's a whole different discussion about the, first of all, it's in the script. It's understanding, again, it relates very specifically to understanding of time length you know, I've really enjoyed recently working in kind of 26 to 28 minutes is really terrific time length for storytelling. I think that it's a, you need to understand how people watch something, what pulls them through to watch the next thing. I think it is in the editing, how you create the kind of metabolism of the show, the pace of information, how it's given, the architecture. You know, Emma, who writes Extraordinary, obviously is just a knockout, brilliant writer, but she's got a really lovely sense of how things loop back around within an episode, but you've also moved the broader story on. I think a lot about making something addictive, giving it like a pace, what the final beat of something is. I think your point about episode ones is interesting, but I think that episode ones are, you need to get them in episode one. I don't think you've got time to rely on episode two to, so I think that episode ones have to have pace, intrigue, immediate story, you know, all of those things. And there are lots of series that you hear of that are really brilliant later, but the episode one doesn't go well. So the algorithm says, sorry guys, we're not going to give you a second series, even though later on, if the first, it relates to the first 10 minutes. And again, that's helpful from shorts and from commercials as well. It's like compression of information.
Everyone's flicking through the television. They're like, what should we watch, a new show? Like, click, not feeling it, next one.
Yeah. Like, how long do you feel that you have? Like, I don't feel like I have until the end of an episode one. I feel like I've got like the first 10 minutes on a streaming show. I feel like it's the first 10, which are really, really key.
Yeah. That makes a ton of sense, because it's one of those where it's, if you can get it early, you'll capture all the people who would have otherwise clicked off, and the people who are inclined to give you more pace, well, they're going to give you more episodes because you got them at the start.
Exactly. People who consume television in a more old-fashioned way, you're going to have them anyway, but you've got to keep the people who are watching on the tube. For me, I think that's to do with falling in love with the characters. That's, to me, is the sort of secret sauce in all of that. If you immediately love a character, you're gonna go with them. And you know, that people are like, you know, there's lots of conversations in TV and film about likability and those kinds of things. But it's something else. It's like, I'm fascinated by this character. I'm, you know, all of those kinds of things. It doesn't have to be, you know, like, I don't know, someone who's really kind. It can be Tony Soprano. But you're still hooked in to that person from the very get-go. On, you know, I suppose Sopranos is a different reference, but like more contemporary streaming shows, you've got to be fascinated or intrigued or those kinds of things very, very early on. And shorts is a really good place to have learned how to do that, I think.
So as a director, I suppose, do you find it, you have to have an innate interest in people, and therefore an interesting character?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, we're talking about industry things and how to make stuff and all of that stuff. But I think as a creative, everything comes down to the character. And I think that that's also the thing that when you're talking to actors or collaborating with actors on that, that's something that the depth that you can get from them, their imaginations are incredible, they're brilliant, all of those things. They can, you know, once you start activating that, and, you know, obviously it comes from the writing, but it's also about the depth that I'll talk with someone who's got a couple of lines, and we'll develop a whole backstory, you know, history, all of those things, everything to help them feel really authentic and for the actor to do that. And that then plays into, even, you know, I'm talking with locations about character, with the art department, with the graphics department. You know, you're trying to get all of that, because I think that's what audiences love. You know, I love like the Coen brothers or that type of depth of character in everything. It's the thing that people really crave with it, and I think that's kind of my way into everything, I think.
And I'm really curious, what are the roles that most often in your experience transition into being directors? So you mentioned kind of actors understanding. You get a lot of actors who become directors.
Actors, cinematographers direct quite a lot. I would say that I've worked with some really young, very talented script supervisors that I've felt could be really good at, really good directors, writers, execs, you know, producers. I don't think it's an exclusive thing, but it's just about how much you can grasp the role, I would say.
So what's quite exciting is, as you say, you kind of kept it close to your chest that you wanted to be a director, that you liked directing. I suppose I think it's quite exciting, but that in various roles across the industry, there's probably a budding director there who's got that innate sense of character, innate sense of story that, you know, given the right set of circumstances, could emerge.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's the thing that I suppose that I try to treat everybody like they're filmmakers, you know, and that's a really exciting thing. If someone brings an idea, or I would never rule that out because it was someone from a department that I didn't think was a thing, or a, you know, I'll often in the walk to, I might walk with a runner who's taking me to a meeting that I need to be in. I might chat with the runner and just take the temperature with them about what they're thinking about those things. I don't think that any of that stuff is exclusive. And I think I suppose the other thing that's happened is that with the ability for everybody to see everything all the time, people's film literacy has gone through the roof. People watch different things. People, you know, when I was like a film nerd, like a total dork about everything, it wasn't that common a thing. But now I feel like almost everybody is they have television obsessions. They're devoting hours and hours, you know, they've watched every episode of The Crown, or they've watched, like, people are watching a lot because it's got so good and so easy and the quality is so good. So everybody has something to say or views on things. And it's kind of interesting. You know, I think that you can, there with, when you're a director, you have to judge when you can be democratic and when you can be autocratic. And that's something that comes maybe with experience, that you can judge that. But I would never rule out a discussion with someone about something. And I think I would encourage people, even if they direct and they don't like it, because it really would help them to understand the whole process. And also, I think, like, heads of department or art directors or all those things, the more you can understand everybody's roles, you know, the better you can make it. So I can understand a location, you know, what the problems of being a, and that helps me to judge the value of it as well, and what they're bringing back. So I think it's really joyful to take a more holistic approach to it as well. Does that make sense in terms of what you're saying about that?
I wonder if we just go back slightly for a keen director. So you made your first short film, it did really well, and you said after that point you would consider yourself, you were a director.
Well, I was still quite like, okay guys, about it, but I suddenly had an agent for film and TV.
And they helped you get your next director?
Like, yeah. And
what was your first paid director?
So I had an agent for film and TV, and they also introduced me to a commercials agent as well. I then did a series of short films for the BBC. That was my first paid job. It was absolutely mind-boggling to be paid for that. I had to do a story. It was three separate stories set in a restaurant. It was when the BBC were doing shorts, and there were other directors who'd done other ones as well, and it was all set in the same restaurant. And my first day of professional directing was, I had to choreograph a love scene, and this was back in the days before intimacy coordinators, because there was a love scene happening when the restaurant had closed down. So that was my first experience of that, and that was just an example of just kind of going for it. I'd worked out all the camera positions and all of those things very fastidiously beforehand.
What's the process of getting that job? So did your agent help you with that process?
Yeah,
did
so
you interview for
it? Yeah, so they put me forward and I interviewed for it. The producer really kindly sort of took a chance on me. And actually, I just recently did a series with him. He's a really brilliant producer called Jake Lushington at World Productions. And I just worked on a series about abuse in tennis with him a couple of years ago. But so, yeah, I got that job and that was my first kind of professional job. But then at the same time, I was still wanting to do more shorts. And I also did my first TV commercial as well, because my short kind of led me into that. And so then for quite a long time, I was making commercials with a really, again, an amazing producer called Mary Francis. And at the same time, I was developing shorts and features, a feature film at the same time.
Did you have regular enough work to keep directing full time, or were you doing other bits on the side?
Yeah, so I kind of did have just enough. It just sort of started. It was just me, so I didn't have huge overheads and that kind of stuff. So I started, I was like 24 or something, 20. So I just started doing that, and that allowed me to, the commercials allowed me to, I loved making the commercials, but that allowed me to develop the film that I was working on with Luke.
Could you briefly talk about the benefits of having a director's agent? So presumably you got one off the back of the festival success.
Yes.
Did they approach you? Did you know that the directors had agents?
What? I was approached, the agent of the director that I was working for, Ian, at the time, I was good friends with his agent's assistant, because we would talk all the time about what Ian was up to. And so she mentioned me to someone at that agency and they took me on. Her name is Eleanor Burns, and she's now a top director's agent. She's really amazing. That's the assistant I was taken on by Jodie. It makes Jodie Shields at Casarotto. So it makes a really big difference. I think that they can put you in touch with lots of projects. I probably made a mistake in that I was very fixated just on making my film, and they sent me lots of wonderful things that I said no to, which was probably a mistake at the time. I should have gone and done some television maybe before trying to make my film, because I still had quite a lot to learn, but I was learning a lot on commercials at the same time.
Is this your short film or your features?
Feature, my feature. But that the development of that took sort of 10 years for us to get that ready. We never quite had it where we wanted it to be. And maybe we were a little bit too, we would have been better off kind of diving in rather than waiting so long, I think possibly, which is a whole other, that's a whole other sort of, the opportunities that you get once you become a director, that's a whole other thing. And that's quite a balance of sort of, like you say, how being freelance, the freelance conundrum.
How do you see the industry changing? It was COVID shut it down. Then there was the big mega boom. And then last year, the industry halved from the year before. Obviously, the strikes had a massive impact onto it. Where do you see the industry going in 24, 25, 26?
I'm not sure if I'm the best person to ask about sort of industry prognostications. I think that there'll still be a lot being made. I don't think the budgets will be as abundant as they were before, is sort of the conversation that I'm having with people. I think that there's a sort of correction coming in terms of the level of budget, and it will just be about whether the companies can adjust their ambitions to those budgets. Whether they, I think that it's interesting that there's a sort of vulnerability in crew at the moment. I think people are, jobs are way less, and that sometimes, you know, it's a bit extreme to talk about it in terms of sort of capital and labor, but like that gives the advantage back to the capital a little bit in terms of that. But I hope that the progressive developments that have been made within the industry sustain, you know, in terms of that. But I think that the exciting thing is that filmmaking is always about being resourceful. You know, it's about how you marshal your resources and being resourceful. So I think it's, even if you have to tell a story with way less, I think you can do it. But again, you need everybody on side with that, all the way up the chain from the, with all those things. So I think that there's, that's really exciting. You know, the technology side of it as well is still developing incredibly, these amazing cameras and all of those things. So I think that part of it is really exciting. But I'm not the best predictor of those things. Why? What have you heard, you guys?
the it'd be interesting because this will come out about that point. That the conversation in crew is that there are lots of productions waiting for the new tax year, and from the conversations I've had with producers, they've said that's largely nonsense. Because there was a lot less shot last year, so it's not like productions need. The feeling is that it is coming back, but I think that from my kind of crystal ball, that's more to do with the days are getting longer, and that there was a lot of sorting with, you know, so many productions went down. So who, what cast was scheduled to what projects? You then had a kind of pile up, and you said, well, I can't do this project because I'm meant to be going back to that project. And so there's kind of been a sorting through, as well as, you know, streamers downsizing how much they're spending because there's kind of consolidation and they're bringing in ads and subscriber growth is kind of stalled. But so it's a question of how much the fog of the strikes is depressing production relative to the past couple of years, and how much of it is a new normal. And I think we won't really be able to tell that till kind of August.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, there are so many more distributors than there ever were before, and it's bizarre because it's only depressed when you compare it to the mega boom.
Yeah.
If you compare it to the industry before the mega boom, it's still billions bigger than it had been for decades.
I guess I'd like to end on one final question, which is just briefly for, I mean, I know from my background, I found it quite intimidating, the idea of being a freelancer.
Mm.
And as Daniel said, there was COVID where, unless you were lucky to be furloughed, you weren't earning. And then during the second and third lockdowns, there was some sort of work happening, and then there was a boom. What is it like working as a freelancer? What would you recommend to someone who's aspiring to work as a freelance director? How do they sustain themselves in a career? You know, what's that process like?
Yeah, I think that's a sort of a really key question in relation to your sense of your own creativity, the kind of the life that you want to have, all of those things. I would, you know, talking to someone at the beginning of their career about being freelance, I would say that it's almost like being a totally separate, it's a separate workforce, a separate life, a separate set of pressures. I don't know that people who are not freelance understand it. I wouldn't blame them for not understanding it. You know, people still, if I spoke about over the years of being freelance, some of the bumpier moments that I've had within it, I think people would think that I was crazy and irresponsible and those kinds of things. So I think that there's a sort of terrible equation between the passion that you have for the thing that you love, the freelance lifestyle. I think that directors are notorious for I remember talking to Rick McCullum, who's a really brilliant producer, who produced the kind of Star Wars prequels, and he said that most of the directors he knew, as soon as they got money, they kind of inflated their lifestyle massively, and then everything collapsed once they had a kind of a box office failure. That's maybe a traditional way of doing it, but I think if you're starting out, you've got to find a way. And I don't know that the kind of younger generation who are dealing with so many different cost of living issues need any kind of lecture from my generation about how to deal with those things. But I think you have to really acknowledge that it's going to be bumpy. And even when I speak to people who have got incredible, you know, careers and, you know, people who are shooting all of the time, it's still bumpy. And the kind of, the you see a lot with actors, but the sort of the shard of insecurity that being freelance puts into you never really leaves you. Even when you're super experienced, you shot loads, you've done everything, you know, you maybe never going to be out of work. It never quite goes away. So I think that that's a really, I think you have to be super realistic about where that's going to take you to. You know, maybe your partner isn't going to be freelancer. They might not understand. Maybe your parents-in-law will never understand your job. Or your friends will always think, you know, why can't you say yes to this date 6 months in advance, or, you know, those kinds of things. So you've got to cut your cloth with it, and also find a way to understand what level of risk you can take with it. For me personally, like the pure joy of working on set and working with people and the moment when you're in an edit and it works and those kinds of things outweighs all of those other things. But, you know, family life and those kinds of things can become complicated. If I was talking to myself way younger, I would say to just like have zero expectations of any lifestyle thing and just be, you know, be really thrifty with it, because there's going to always be moments. And it doesn't matter, like I say, it doesn't matter who you talk to. People always have gaps, you know, it's how you live in those gaps. I've now gone through the gap so many times or in enough times. I've gone through the gaps enough times to realize that when I have a gap, I should enjoy it, you know.
And that it's not necessarily you that's faulty. You
know, yeah.
People might take it like, oh, maybe I'm just really rubbish. Or
yeah, totally. But so now when I have a pause, which it fortunately hasn't been very often, I'm living it up in a very inexpensive way.
Yeah, but I guess because you talked about your love of film, you're using that time to watch films. And
yeah, that's my wife just thinks I'm crazy, because as soon as I finish filming, then all I'm basically doing is watching films, reading books about films. And my great passion is to take like a certain film or a certain director, and then what I'll do is watch everything, like go through a few days of watching absolutely everything. Yeah, totally. I'll read everything. And, you know, there's such a lovely, you know, talking about film books, there's such a brilliant uptick in like big books about a specific film or a specific director and all of those things. And so that's like my way of relaxing is more film after filming. But that's why I talk about the joy of it. It's just such a joy and a pleasure, and to the joy of collaboration is that you get to share with other people who have similar joys of filmmaking, and that's the thing that I love absolutely the most. You know, if I think about Melanie Allen, the designer on Extraordinary, it's just like a total joy to share in our delight in how things can look and character and sets and all those things.
I'm going to be really cheeky and ask one extra final question.
Ask away.
What is the best piece of advice you've ever gotten?
As a director, Ian Softley, before he went away so he was going off to make this film with Jeff Bridges in Los Angeles, and he knew that I was going to do the short. And he just said to me, don't worry about anything technical. Just get it how you want it. Concentrate on the story and doing that. And that piece of advice was so brilliant, because, and I always say that to other people, because what it allows you to do is, I think that when you start off as a filmmaker, you're worrying about like lenses, and I see everyone with, you know, like their Artemis out, and they're like, or they're worrying about like, how am I going to do that? Like and they worry so much about the things that they don't understand, that they feel they ought to understand. And I talk to people and they're like, well, I'm not going to do this yet because I still don't really get as much of this. And I'm like, whoa, hold on. Like bring in, you know, when you put your team together, bring in people that really know how to do that. So on the short that I then did, Luke really brilliantly asked Nick Noland, one of the great black and white British cinematographers ever, to come and do Richard Tame, John Wayne. And so from that point on, I didn't worry about any of those things. And so we just did it, you know. And that piece of advice combined with, I would say I once went to, Luke did a DVD of short films, of great short films compilation. And he sent me to Los Angeles to get he did commentaries with all the directors, Lim Ramsey, Christopher Nolan, all these people. And I was in Los Angeles and he sent me to see Ridley Scott and to record the commentary of Ridley Scott's first short film, which is called Boy on a Bicycle, starred Tony Scott, his brother, who obviously went on to be a brilliant director. And I sort of sat in Ridley's trailer when he'd just come off set. He was shooting Matchstick Men with Nicolas Cage. And he came off set, sat down, it was lunch, and we played the short on his TV. And he just said his approach, and I know lots of people have listened to him about it. He was just like, if you want to make a film, just do it. He was like, obviously he was from commercial, so he loved the Nike attitude. So he was just like, just, as Nike say, just do it. So I think that combined with Ian's advice about not worrying about something technical is sort of the way to just step into it. Obviously that contradicts a little bit with what I was saying about being calculated about your audience. But I think the two things, that the three pieces of advice can kind of coalesce, because you free yourself from the worry to just go and tell the story and collaborate with people to do it, I think. And you just go and do it. I mean, that's the best way to do it, I think.
If you go and do it, it happens. If you don't, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And then nothing happens.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to learn one way or the other, I think, is what Ridley Scott is always his thing. And there's like a relentless sort of forward motion to whatever he does. And he's still doing it at 85 and all those things. And I suppose that for him to have that attitude, and for someone like Ian, who's technically so gifted and moves the camera as well as any English director of recent times, just beautiful stuff, for him to just say that is really liberating, I think. And so I wouldn't let your worries about things prevent you from going to tell the story.
As a producer, you feel like your job is to make sure that the director doesn't have to think about all those things. So your cinematographer and your technicians are thinking, like, as basically as a producer, I always feel that to get the director to the point where they can just focus on story and character is the primary job of a producer, as well as being, you know, emotional support and
so many millions of things.
But it's a really critical thing, I think, from a producer director relationship, is allow the director to really do what they do, which is your craft is the telling of a story.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that I suppose thematically as well, from this talk, it's like it's about collaboration and sharing, trying to find ways to share the joy and the inevitable pain of filmmaking with people who love filmmaking with you is the only way to do it, I think.
Amazing, thank you.
This has been absolutely brilliant.
Such a pleasure.
Oh, good. Thanks, guys. Thank you. I hope it's helpful to people who are starting out. I always say to lots of people that I've worked with have gone on to direct, you know, Alex Lawther is a really brilliant director. Freddie Seiborn, who wrote Old Boys, is a terrific director now as well. And I always say that they saw me doing it, so they felt that if this idiot can do it, then they can as well. But I really feel like that people should feel liberated to go and try it if they want to. And I would hope that's what they would take away from this as well.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.